Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio, a podcast. It's free, but it's short. Shorter than the full show, and the full show is available to you for just literally a handful of change a day. You can get it over at rofpodcast.com. When you do, you're not only supporting the show, you're not only getting three times more show than you're listening to now, but you also get access to over 10 years worth of our archives with guests that you cannot believe. Head over there now, rofpodcast.com. When you do, you keep this show trucking and you get bonus material. Thanks again for listening. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, healthcare reporter Caitlin Kelly will be here to explain how we only need to look to our neighbor to the north to see what Medicare for All looks like. Progressive congressional candidate Nabila Islam will join us to discuss her race in Georgia's 7th District. And Heather Digby Parton will be here to run down all the biggest news of this crazy week. And editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan, will be here to cover some of his incredible reporting over this past couple of weeks, starting with a Wells Fargo attorney who is moonlighting as a campaign policy advisor to a certain South Bend mayor. Are you listening on one of our radio affiliates right now? Well, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio program commercial-free with access to years and years of our archives. Go to rofpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down the most important stories of the week. Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, you know, I think we predicted back in December that as insane as things have been for the past 3 years in terms of the volume and the pace of news, we suspected that it was going to increase even from that astonishing level. And so far, that is the case. I mean, before we came on air, we realized that we still have yet to address the downing of a Ukrainian airline by Iran in the wake of their retaliatory strikes against the United States, strikes that they had provided the U.S. military with information as to where they were going to strike so that essentially no one was injured. It was largely symbolic. It remains to be seen if there's not going to be anything more than there. But basically, that was Iran ratcheting down the conflict with the U.S., but then accidentally shooting down a plane of almost 200 people, and all of whom who perished, and a horrific situation that sparked more protests in Iran. And there is still an ongoing drama within Iran between reformists and revolutionaries and those, you know, anti-imperialists, I should say. And so all of that continues out. But that is now, because it's, you know, 5 days later, pushed to the side as we have the 2020 election really heating up. We are just now a couple of weeks away, literally 2 weeks away from the Iowa caucuses. And of course, we have impeachment finally making it to the Senate. And if that wasn't enough, then a whole new set of at least facts and accusations and testimony and documents that you and I could spend months talking about if there was no other news. So let's start with what happened with the 2020 race this week, because that why not? I don't really know where the best place to start with this stuff. But of course, there was a debate this week that ended up being sort of the secondary or the tertiary story of the 2020 election this week. There was only five people on that debate stage: Sanders, Warren, Biden, Buttigieg, and Klobuchar, excuse me, six, and Tom Steyer. And in the meantime, leading up to that debate, there was a report in CNN that four anonymous sources close to Elizabeth Warren had said that Bernie Sanders had told her in a meeting in 2018 that he didn't think a woman could win the presidency in this cycle, presumably. The claims were vague. Sanders' people denied that he had said that. And then later that day, Elizabeth Warren came out and said that she, when they met, she thought that a woman could win. And this is more or less a quote: he disagreed, is what she put out. And then, of course, we have the handshake that never happened, and the trading of questioning about lies at the end of the debate. Heather, are you ready to quit politics altogether yet, or what?
Pretty much. I would rather stick chopsticks in my ears than have to listen to much more of this Warren Sanders flap. I mean, I'll be honest with you. In the midst, as you point out, you know, we had, and we came, you know, within a hair's breadth of war just last week. And it really was. That's no joke. It was for real. Anything could have happened. We're in the middle of an impeachment. The Russian government just resigned en masse because Vladimir Putin is pretty much declaring himself president for, you know, for life. You know, we've got Australia, by the way, is on fire. And, yes. And it is a living hell. A billion animals have been killed. To be obsessing over this tiff between Warren and Sanders seems like a bit of a waste of the media's time and energy. Now, I get between the left, of course, this was bound to happen. I mean, just to, you know, go into it and then leave it behind. It was bound to happen because these two are representing the same faction of the Democratic Party. And it's a pretty big faction when you look at their numbers combined, that are people who are, you know, at least ideologically content to be, you know, to vote for either one of them.
Right.
And so, of course, there, you know, we're getting down to the wire here. And by the way, the polling shows it's pretty much a jump ball in Iowa. And that means that, you know, they're jostling. Their staffs are jostling. They're getting, you know, they're tired already. I mean, this is it's a long haul in a presidential race. And this is where it always gets like this. I mean, I just to give some perspective, you know, you remember this, Sam. Back in 2004, John Kerry ran a disgusting ad against Howard Dean in which he, you know, sort of morphed him into Osama bin Laden. I mean, it was grotesque. And the left went crazy over it, of course, you know, went back and forth. I mean, this is where it gets in this stage of the campaign. And I'm not saying that there isn't anything to this. As a woman, I can totally see why Elizabeth Warren might have taken, you know, Bernie's admonition that Trump was going to weaponize, you know, misogyny, and see that as him trying to, you know, warn her off in that way. And I could see him thinking, hey, that's not fair. I'm just being practical. That conversation is being had by everybody. I myself have had it, I don't know, probably 50 times since 2016.
Right.
Can a woman
right.
win? So this is not an uncommon thing for people to be thinking and talking about and worrying about, even among women, maybe especially among women. So, you know, all of this is just, it is part of what's going on. I think Warren skillfully sort of put out the idea that, hey, you know, women can win. I mean, that's, she has to say that, right? I mean, she can't say, well, you know, he is right. I mean, women can't win, or, yeah, you know how that is. But, you know, she did point out that, you know, women do win elections, that they won a lot in 2018, and that was fair enough for her. And it was also fair for Bernie to say, hey, look at my record on this. You know, I am the last person anyone should accuse of being a misogynist. You know, I've been pushing this for decades. So, you know, I mean, it's just not a big deal. And I really believe that in the end, whichever one of them, whether it's Sanders or Warren, if either one of them gets to the top, I know that the other one, I think they'll do it for anybody, but they've all promised to, but particularly for each other, they will do everything in their power to bring that their people over. I really believe it, especially if it's one or the other of them. I mean, there's no way that that kind of bad blood, that they won't do everything in their power to make sure that that doesn't happen. So I guess, long story short, I'm not concerned. I think it's going to be fine.
Yeah, I mean, I agree largely with that assessment. I'm trying to see if I can find it here, and maybe we should just take a break, and we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more about this, and you know, about the other. There are other people who are running in the the election, and we are very close to it. We've been talking about it for a year, and now it's nearly upon us, and all we're talking about is a handshake that didn't happen.
Yeah,
we got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with the great Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Digby. So, Heather, we've been talking about the obviously, not obviously, because there's literally five different topics that we could be talking about that we could talk about for this entire program. But we are talking about the 2020 Democratic primary. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has already done three or four rallies, I think, at this point. Ohio, Wisconsin, and I should say northwestern Ohio. So essentially touching on a big part of Michigan in terms of media exposure. Also, he did one in Wisconsin. These are obviously crucial states for Trump, but also the Democratic nominee. And this was done with the backdrop, the final debate before the first primary slash caucus. That would be the Iowa caucus. And notoriously, the polling has been more or less off, it seems to me, going into these Iowa caucuses. Now, I think generally the person who is clearly in the lead ends up winning, but it ends up being a higher percentage. At least that's the way I think it worked with Kerry and Obama in the past two primaries that we've had there. But the thing is that it's hard to sort of get a sense of exactly who's in the lead in Iowa at this point. I think you said earlier it's more or less a jump ball. I think it's going to be, you know, it could be very clarifying as to what happens. My personal feeling, last words on this Warren Bernie situation, I agree with your assessments. I think both of them, it's perfectly, like you said, I think you and I have had conversations about whether we are in an era when a woman could win against a Donald Trump as he's weaponizing misogyny. And, you know, it seems perfectly reasonable to me that both of them could come out of that conversation with a slightly different take on how definitive each other were on that. And I happen to think that if Warren wanted to avoid at least tagging Bernie with this, she had an opportunity to do so. My sense is, and like you say, this is not beanbag. But relatively to what we saw like in 2008, you and I remember this, you know, Puma, and I don't want to give you PTSD, but we remember, you know, party unity, my ass was what the Clinton people were saying, you know, going into the convention in 2008. Yep. And so what we're seeing here, and you mentioned, you know, John Kerry had an ad that morphed Howard Dean into Osama bin Laden. I mean, there was a lot of stuff like this. That was, frankly, far worse, it seems to me. You know, there are still some axes to be ground, I think, by some segments of the Democratic Party against Bernie Sanders. Sanders, supporters, or at least, on social media, tend to be younger. And so they're, I think, more aggressive on social media than some of us olds are. But with all that said, I think this was a strategy by Warren to not necessarily get votes from Sanders, because I think they probably understand that a lot of those votes are, Sanders may or may not have a ceiling, but he certainly, his support is pretty solid. I think this was an attempt to show people who maybe Warren is second choice for, as opposed to their first choice being Biden or Buttigieg, that she could get into a fight, that she was tough, that if you're worried about a woman being able to beat Donald Trump, this, I think, was a strategy to exhibit that. Now, I don't know if it works. We will find out if that's the case. I think she was looking to draw some of those voters away from Biden and Buttigieg, and Bernie Sanders had to be the example that she was, going to fight with and show that type of strength. I don't have a sense of if that worked, but I guess we will find out in the coming weeks. We're going to find out two things. We're going to find out if that worked. We're going to find out if Bernie Sanders, the theory of his campaign, is works in practice, which is that if Sanders, if Sanders is able to execute what the theory is, they're going to bring out voters that were not captured by any of the polling. Right. That's the theory, that Sanders was going to turn out voters, bring voters into the process that otherwise would not show up. And therefore, you probably wouldn't have the ability to model your polling to capture those voters. So there's going to be a lot that we're going to understand after Iowa. And of course, and I want your opinion on this. If Joe Biden comes in fourth in Iowa and then comes in third in New Hampshire, I think he's in big trouble. What's your sense of that? We just got about 45 seconds left, and then we've got more to talk about later in the program.
I agree with you. I mean, I don't think he has to win either one, but he's got to be in the top two to maintain this sort of. I mean, people will drop away in the next primaries, and I'm sure his polling will drop elsewhere if he's not seen as at least competing in those first two states, because that, that's just kind of the kiss of death. So I will be looking for that. I agree. This is really key for him.
Yeah. So, folks, keep an eye on those aggregations of polls. Keep your eyes on the prize. At least I think Heather and I can agree. The worst case scenario is a Buttigieg or a Biden nomination in terms of ones that look like they're possible. So for progressives, I think the idea is full steam ahead, but make it, keep your eyes on the prize. We got to take a break. Heather, if you'll join me in the next hour, we've got about a million other things to talk about. This week. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back after this. Coming up, how the Canadian healthcare system could be an example for Medicare for all in this country. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Sam Cedar here. Co-hosting Ring of Fire is the highlight of my week, but I got a day job too. Every weekday, I host the Majority Report, covering the news of the day and interviewing great progressive guests. And now it's super easy for you to tune in. We just released an app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. Go to MajorityApp.com to download, and you can listen live or to recorded versions of past shows, and it's totally free. That's MajorityApp.com. Download and listen for free. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. A strong push for Medicare for All has become a major progressive policy initiative in the run-up to the 2020 election. But what would it look like? Here to lay out how it works in Canada, longtime health reporter Caitlin Kelly. So, Caitlin, obviously, one of the big issues in the Democratic primary has been the question of Medicare for all, and broadly speaking, in this country, healthcare has been a dominant topic, really, I don't know, for the entire decade in many respects, starting with the Affordable Care Act debate and the ongoing debate about the Affordable Care Act and the attempts by Republicans to roll it back, and then their failure and the desire by Democrats, at least, to improve upon our healthcare delivery system. And you have written about Medicare for all, but not in the American context, in the context of Canada. Let's talk about that. When Canadians say Medicare for all, they're literally talking about Medicare for all, their system. Walk us through the contours of that system. If I am a person who has kids and I've got to go see a doctor, what happens?
Yeah, thank you for asking and thanks for having me. So every Canadian, by virtue of being Canadian, by living there, pays taxes, as we do in the United States. The difference is for Canadians that pay taxes, those taxes pay for their health care. Canadians don't have to pay for hospital care, doctor care. They do pay for medications. They do pay for some outpatient. So if you want to see a doctor, you want to take your kids to a doctor, typically what you do is you see your family physician or GP. The difference there, which is actually quite crucial and it manages cost, is that the GP is a gatekeeper. So let's say, for example, you see something funny on your arm and think, I want to see a dermatologist. You don't go directly to the dermatologist. You have to see your GP or your family physician, and they say, yeah, you're right, let me refer you. Or, you know what, it, you know, this is nothing serious. That's not something you need to do. But there is a gatekeeper who will, by definition, slow your roll in terms of just rushing to the next specialist. It's not to suggest that Americans can get to everybody they need either. I live in New York and I've got lots of doctors that I have to see. So my perspective is really unusual because I lived in Canada till I was 30 and was a health reporter there. My parents are there. I see the care they get, which can be very intensive and free. And then I see what it's like down here. I'm paying $1,400 a month for my health insurance as a freelancer. So it's a real burden for some Americans.
Okay. All right. So I just want to back up. Now,
please.
Is Medicare, and it's called Medicare in Canada, is that right?
Well, some people call it that. I mean, we just call it health insurance. I honestly, living there, never called it Medicare. That is the official name for it. But, you know, we just sort of say health insurance. We don't really
right. I guess if it's like on some level, it's like Kleenex, right? I mean, if there's only one of them,
really
you don't really need to differentiate it from anything else because that's all that exists.
Exactly.
Okay. Well,
exactly. And every province gives you a card. You have a health card. So in Ontario, it's the OHIP, Ontario Health Insurance Plan. It looks like a credit card. It looks like your health insurance card. And once you have your OHIP card or whatever province you live in, you have it province by province, away you go. That just allows you to go use the system.
Now, is this available only to citizens? In other words, if I have the equivalent of a green card in Canada, how does it work if I'm I'm not a citizen? Like, what are there specific tiers, or is it just it is exclusively for Canadian citizens?
Well, no, because if you're the great question. I mean, I live here in the States and I'm a Canadian on a green card. I pay the same tax as everybody else. And in Canada, if you're what's called a permanent resident, it's a different language, you have the same access. If I went back to Canada tomorrow to live, to escape this terrible cost burden, it would take me, I believe, 6 months to get back into the system because I would be paying 6 months worth of taxes. Now, I am a Canadian citizen, but it's not based on citizenship. It's residency and tax paying. So refugees, for example, Canada welcomes a lot of refugees, and they get care once they've arrived.
Once they've arrived or once they've paid taxes for 6 months?
No, that's a good question, but my understanding is that actually once they've arrived,
okay,
because it's part of a sort of a humanitarian mindset that says, if you're a refugee and we're going to take you in, you know, we're going to give you what you need. And, you know, they get processed, and some people probably won't stay permanently, but my understanding is that once they arrive, they're set. And obviously, it's not a huge number of people, but yes.
Right. Okay. And so when I go see the doctor, it is, are there co-pays? Are there any? Do I have to fill out forms? I just show my card and that's it?
Pretty much. You know, you would fill out the same form we do down here, like, you know, sort of just your family medical history, right? I mean, it's a standard medical intake form. Yeah.
Right.
But no copays. I mean, I will be honest, it is so strange for a Canadian, and I've lived here a long, long time in the United States. I still can't get over the bizarreness for me of standing there and there's like a debit card machine at a medical counter. I just find this so weird. It's completely normal for Americans that you whip out a credit card, you whip out a debit card. Canadians don't. They pull out their health card because their taxes have paid for the service, whether they use it or not. If you're hospitalized for 6 months and have 10 surgeries, it's covered. You will not get a bill.
And so what do you, I mean, it sounds like basically more or less the experience I have when I go to the YMCA to swim or to play basketball. I show my card.
Interesting.
The first time I show up there, I fill out a form that says I'm this. I join up and boom, I just show my card. I come in. What do you pay for in terms of healthcare? What do you pay? What about like eyeglasses, dentist, prescription drugs?
Great question.
What are those?
Yes, exactly. So thank you for asking. So the big question now, and it's a very big issue in Canada, is called pharmacare. So Canada does not cover medication, and that's a real challenge. In Britain, the NHS does. My insurance here in America does cover my medication. Canada does not. And Canada has the second highest medication costs in the world after the United States. So it's a real issue, and it's becoming a very big political issue to make sure that the taxes that you pay for healthcare cover your medication. So not dental, not vision, not strangely things like physical therapy, occupational therapy. Basically, the system was designed way back in the 1960s, and it hasn't in some ways been massively updated as it needs to be with an aging population, for example, so that anything in a hospital, it's covered. Anything in a doctor's office is covered. But you leave the hospital, you need a walker, you need crutches, you need a cane, you have to pay for that. So it's very odd in some ways. It's very good in some ways, but it has some weaknesses.
So there's a, sort of like a it feels like it's sort of like designed pre the concept of wellness on some level, and it's reflecting that. So what happens with that other care? Are there sort of supplemental insurance companies, private insurance companies?
Yes.
Okay, how does that work?
Yeah, and it's not so much. It is a private insurance company. So here, for example, when you have a full-time job, they say, we'll give you benefits, right? And then you get your subsidized health insurance. In Canada, and I was very healthy there, I didn't need this, but if I wanted those services, I could buy through my employer with a subsidy a plan that would cover those things. So in the story that I wrote for the American Prospect,
who would subsidize
patients?
I'm sorry, you said subsidy. Who would subsidize? The government?
The employer. The way that it is in the United States as well, your employer would help you with the cost of that plan. So for example, one of the people I interviewed at some point, which was really rough, $900 a month of medication she needed, but her husband had a very good plan through his job. Had she not had the husband and the husband had the plan, $900 is a very big hit. Bizarrely, some Canadians can't even afford their insulin, which is made in Canada, invented in Canada, because they have to pay for it. So you can either get it through your job or you can buy a plan.
I see. Okay. And so that is, I mean, largely like it's sort of as if the American system ran parallel to a Medicare for all system, but it's just the supplemental. So when, for instance, like analogous to Bernie Sanders saying, under our system, you would get covered for all of these things, including eyes and dental and whatnot. But if you wanted cosmetic surgery, for instance, you could get health insurance for that. If you thought down the road you would need it. But in Canada, that distribution in terms of what the individual, I guess, is responsible for and can buy on a sort of a market is slightly different. All right. Well, we got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about a little bit more about the Canadian system, how it's financed, and also what are some of the drawbacks of the Canadian system.
Sure.
We got to take a quick break. I'm talking to Caitlin Kelly about her piece in the American Prospect, what Medicare for All really looks like, at least north of the border. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I tried to do handstands for you. I tried to do headstands for you. Every time I fell on you. Every time I fell for you on permanent.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to healthcare reporter Caitlin Kelly about her piece in The American Prospect, what Medicare for All really looks like. So, Caitlin, in the last segment, you explained to us that as a Canadian, a former Canadian healthcare reporter living in the United States, though you've been here for quite some time, and getting healthcare seems bizarre at times because of the credit card payment system that is at the front desk of all these medical outlets. But you were comparing and contrasting medical services and, or I should say, payments in America to Canada. In Canada, all of you have told us that all of our hospital, all of our doctor visits would be covered, but outpatient things, any type of physical therapy, any type of pharmaceuticals, any type of sort of wellness stuff and dental, eyes, not covered by the governmental health insurance system, but instead are either available as health insurance bought on a private market or through one's employer. So there is still a private market for health insurance there, but it is supplemental. What are people's perspectives on that in terms of like dental and vision? And how much cheaper is it because you don't have like the burden of a healthcare system that pays for when someone gets cancer or something to that effect?
Right. The dental vision, I mean, I'm not to be dismissive. They're important things, but I'm going to put it into a slightly different context, which is when I lived in Canada, which was, you know, ages 5 to age 30, which is a long time, and I was very athletic and sporty and, you know, had injuries and tore all the ligaments in my ankle, was on crutches for weeks. The difference there, and it's a really important difference, is yes, you want dental and vision, but if you are in the hospital, if you are suddenly, for example, thrown into an ambulance because you need an ambulance, well, that's not a $5,000 surprise. It's covered. You are taken to a hospital, and they're going to say, well, are you in network? You actually might be comatose or unconscious. You can't answer, oh, wait a minute, the hospital's not in network. Your surgeon's not in network. Your anesthesiologist is not in network. Now you're $500,000 or $100,000 or whatever in debt because of the American system. That does not happen in Canada. So I can't say too strongly, that is the key difference. No Canadian ever in their lifetime, ever, will fear medical bankruptcy. And we know that Americans do fear it because it's real. It's a very serious problem here, even if you have insurance. And that, to me, is really the major difference, is that there just isn't that kind of anxiety. There are other things one can fear. There are waits. There are issues with access sometimes. There are definitely challenges with the Canadian system. But fearing medical bankruptcy, worrying that you can't afford an ambulance, which is madness. I mean, it's really shocking. Americans are taking Ubers to the hospital. That's just not sensible. I mean, that's really not a good choice. And in Ontario, an ambulance will cost you $50 out of pocket. That's the reality. So to me, that's a better system, regardless of vision or dental. I mean, I can get my eyeglasses every couple of years. My dentist lets me pay him on a payment plan because I'm freelance. So I am not dismissing that those are unimportant, but relative to the really bad financial shocks that happen to Americans, even with insurance, I think it's still a very good option.
Let's talk about what we hear in terms of complaints with the Canadian system. Now, we know that health outcomes, by any measure that has been adopted by any institution that measures such things, Canada has better health outcomes, just broadly speaking. Yep. But what are the downsides of this system as articulated by Canadians?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question. So really, there's two things that come up constantly, which is access. Can you get to a doctor? Can you get a family physician? And wait times. So access, and this is really shocking. So in a city like Montreal, which is a very sophisticated big city, or Toronto, which is a sophisticated big city, people sometimes can't even get a family physician, which is really shocking. These are major cities. How is that possible? The answer is somewhat complex, but sometimes they just can't. Once they get one, then they're fine. The wait time issue is also, for some people, very, very frustrating. So, for example, if you have cancer, if you're having a heart attack, if you're having something acute, you will be seen. If you want cataract surgery, if you need your knee replaced or your hip replaced, something that is less acute, less emergent, you are probably going to wait. You're not going to wait years, but you might wait 6 months. You might wait a year. And that is stressful. That causes anxiety. The people in my story expressed it. I have friends who've had this experience. I had a friend told last summer, your blood looks a little funny. We'll get you to a hematologist. Nobody wants to hear that. And nobody wants to wait 6 months, as she did, to see the hematologist who said, you're fine. But those 6 months were anxious. Canadians don't like that. But they don't fear the bankruptcy. So the trade-off is made, hey, we're going to have to wait. We don't like waiting. Nobody likes waiting, believe me. But they do like knowing that the care will be medically good, that they will live longer lives than Americans, which is now sadly right. True. Mortality is increasing for Americans. It's shocking given what Americans spend, right? Twice the GDP on health care than Canadians.
So, okay,
so
then,
even with the paper system, you're getting better outcomes.
What is the... I mean, I imagine it's complex, but what are the broad strokes of why that wait exists? I mean, if I wanted to design a system where that wouldn't happen, what would I need to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really complicated answer. The quickest answer is it's a couple of sort of factors combined. So you don't have everybody in the specialties that you need. One of the answers given to me, which was not in my story, is that many women are coming into medicine. They're only working part-time because they want to raise families and have a balanced life so they can work 2 or 3 days a week. Well, those are 2 or 3 days a week you can't get to that doctor because she's not in the office. And or doctors are choosing to go into specialties, which means the family physicians, who are the gatekeepers everybody needs, there are not as many as perhaps they need. And then people are moving to smaller cities and smaller towns because they're less expensive. Toronto is now extraordinarily expensive. So a lot of people are moving out of the big cities, but when they get to the small towns that are affordable for housing, there aren't enough doctors. That's a real challenge.
It's actually sort of the distribution of doctors.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Yep.
And all right. Well, I mean, it's fascinating. And I think it's, you know, worth assessing those differences there in terms of these two things. But I mean, clearly, at the end of the day, the Canadian system, as it is anyways, seems to be working better. All right, lastly, I should just ask you, based upon the fact that people pay taxes instead of actually out of pocket, what's the top tax rate in Canada? I mean, do you pay like 80-90% taxes for everybody? What is
it? No. And again, forgive me, I don't have the figures at my fingertips. The tax rate is not wildly higher. The difference would be, and the minute you go to Canada, I go home a lot, anything you buy, stick of gum, a postage stamp, you pay tax. And it's called HST, and it's a harmonized sales tax. It's a combination of provincial and federal. So you're going to pay 15% tax on just about any single thing you buy. Those taxes add up really quickly. People assume it must be massive income tax. Don't forget, tax comes in lots of places. Gas right. is taxed, liquor is taxed, cigarettes are taxed. So it's not just coming out of one person's pocket. The Americans always assume, I don't want to pay tax. It's going to hit my income. Hello, corporate tax, payroll tax, you know, excise tax. There are many sources of revenue. It doesn't have to be just from our pockets.
Caitlin Kelly, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was great. Appreciate it.
Caitlin Kelly is an author and former reporter for 3 major dailies in Canada and the U.S. You can learn more on her website, CaitlinKelly.com. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show and hear what you've been missing.